Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Monday, August 22nd, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. And these tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description and explanation of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet, and it's a tool I've been using to great effect for 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one where people have been stepped through that worksheet process, and if you choose to listen to them, they can serve as a powerful tutorial for you to get the most benefit from these tools. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. You can also go to your app store and type the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness and get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet. It contains an abbreviated version of the worksheet process, and it contains a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope people do that soon and often because primarily it has been our experience that that leads people to have an improved experience of life and relationships. And secondarily, it tends to lead to comments and questions, answers and testimonials. And if you have any of those to share with us, we'd be grateful if you would call 563-999-3581. Call that number and press 1. And it'll put a little icon of a hand by your phone number, and I'll turn on the microphone and announce you by your area code. We can have a conversation. And we appreciate when people do that because it makes it far easier for us to live into our intention with this work. And the intention with this work is to be of service. So let us know how we can be of service to you. And we have been working through the Way of Mastery this year since January 10th. And if you are interested in getting access to those files, they are available in the regular archive of this show at whyagain.org. If you go to whyagain.org and click on the picture of the microphone, it will take you to a page where you can get access to the last 11-plus years of recordings of this show, 5 days a week, 1 hour a day for the first 8 years, and 2 hours a day for the last 3-plus years. And another way to get access to what we've been doing since January 10th is to go to the mindshiftersacademy.org website, mindshiftersacademy, all one word, .org. And there's several pages on there. One of them is for this work, The Way of Mastery with Commentary. And another one has the first 12 lessons, just the audio files of me reading the lessons. And there is a page that says, you know, highlight pages or highlight files from this show. That's probably five or six shows have been singled out for that page. And we're open to suggestions about shows you've heard or you'd like to review that you think should be placed in the best of or the highlight shows for that. At this point, it's getting my organizational skills are pretty much tapped out because we've got over 150 shows that we've done since the beginning of the year, and you can find them. I suppose you could search for them through the search feature, but scrolling down through 150 shows is oppressive for most. So if there's one that you've heard or that you find when you go back through it and you think this should be in the highlights page, please let me know. You can send me an email at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org. And we'll do what we can to make that happen. So we're at the point where we finished reading Lesson 19 on Friday, and as we usually do, after we finish reading a lesson, we pause and ask, what's bubbling up for you? What are you finding of value in this? Or what could we shift or change focus or add a little bit more of or do a little bit less of that would increase the value for you? So we're going to take some time here in the beginning of our show today to ask for comments and questions and feedback. Five six three nine 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 three five eight one. And if you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. Michael and Jeannie are vacationing this week, and so all week long we will have the flexibility to end a little bit early if that seems to be the appropriate thing to do, and then shift over into the Aramaicisms, the files for the talk that Dale Allen Hoffman and Michael Rice did together out in the Carolinas back in 2015, I believe it was. And that series of 2 nights, 2 hours each, will be broken into 4 shows this week. And that will be a blessing for many that haven't had the experience of it, and a nice review for others if they have. And then on Friday of this week, that second hour of the show will probably just be a replay of the time that I interviewed Dale Allen Hoffman. And so we have time for comments and questions. We can even discuss something about what's going to be coming up in the Aramaicisms or the dynamics that lead people to think that going back to the ancient Aramaic holds a power or a value for our lives today. Area code 610, is this Susan?
It is. I'm unexpectedly able to be here today, at least for a while. It's pouring rain, so our project is on hold. Anyway, I didn't hear the Lesson 19, so I'm not commenting on that, but I've finally gotten around to doing the 5-minute Mind of Christ meditation. It's messy, but I love that you say, oh, it doesn't matter however it happens. The permission is to have it be whatever it is. It's been very, that's been the ticket for me to be able to do it. And I use it in the middle of the night because I have these long periods of wakefulness that are usually full of unhappy thoughts and scary thoughts and so forth. And to just lie still and to bring in the idea that I don't have to sit in my mind, I can put on the mind of Christ, has been made a huge difference. First of all, I do get back to sleep eventually, but it's really exciting and very pleasant to not know anything. And I had to laugh to myself because the only way, I know this is improper use of not knowing, but the only way I can not judge anyone is if I don't know anything. And I figure the only way anybody can have the mind of Christ is to not know anything. As soon as you know something, or you think you know something, then you're already judging. I'm talking about myself. So I don't know whether this is a testimonial or a question, but if anything grabs you and want to comment on that not knowing, I think there's the kind of open, allowing, not knowing that's curious and benevolent, and my kind of not knowing, which is, I think I do know, but I'm going to pay no attention to it. So, because if I do, I'll start judging. So anyway, thanks for that exercise. It's taken about a month to get going on it, but it's a really good one to use.
Well, and, you know, the idea of knowing is just a fantasy. It's another part of the illusion. It's like the dream of separation itself. We're going to use what our senses show us, tiny, tiny, tiny bits of the truth of life, to formulate our knowings. And it's ridiculous. So we can go with what's ridiculous, that we can create our whole experience of life in that dream of separation, that fantasy, because we have the freedom to do that. And when we find that we don't like how it feels, we've got the option. We don't always know we have the option. We haven't been trained to think we have the option. We've literally been conditioned to believe that unless we know some kind of a pat answer, we're going to get at least a bad grade, if not punished.
Right. Well put.
That's our school system, right? And so we've been trained into this for decades. It's no wonder that it's uncomfortable and it feels very different and awkward for us to sit in the childlike curiosity of questioning and openness and not knowing and understanding that even when some kind of a knowledge-based answer comes to us, it's extraordinarily limited in its usefulness and application. And it's only a part of what's going on in the moment. It's never the whole thing. It can't be the whole thing. My senses can't show me the world that it can't register. Right? Just keep bringing yourself back to the fact that you didn't create yourself, and so you don't know when you were created. You don't know who or how you were created. You don't know, and you can't see more than maybe 1% of the electromagnetic spectrum. You can't hear more than maybe 1% of the vibratory spectrum. And whatever your senses are registering from either the sound and the sight and the sensations of touch, only a tiny fraction of that is registering in your mind.
Mm.
So just keep coming back to the facts, and it makes it easier to understand we don't really know. Right? Think about how the scientists, our best scientists these days, are have an estimate that what they can see and measure in matter and energy in the universe is 20% or less of what's actually out there, even with all of their best instruments. And yet we want to say we know what's right and we know what's wrong and we know the answer to this. And so there are these various truths and observations we can use to bring us into the awareness that we really don't know much of anything. And we can then begin to experience what it's like to live in the questioning state, in that open, allowing, being in the moment without the labeling state. And again, it's going to take some practice because there's such a tremendous momentum behind and lots of practice at holding this false belief as though it's the truth, that we know and we can know and we will find out and we'll get it right. There's no getting it done and there's no being right. There is staying in the process and there is aligning with what is right. But there's no being right, just like there's no possessing wisdom. Wisdom can't be possessed, it can only be accessed. And it's there for everyone to access. It's in your heart center. It's in your consciousness, in your awareness. And that's why all of these exercises from the Way of Mastery are not about going to an outside teacher or master. It's about learning to turn within and sit with your breath and observe and sit with your own sensations and your own internal observations and learning to identify where you have become or become aware of where you've become identified with a label or a judgment about yourself or somebody else, and learn to release that. Because the label and the judgment is the opposite of love, of the flow of life.
Right.
It's of the ego, and love allows all things, surrenders to all things, embraces all things, and thereby transcends all things. Ego judges all things, labels them, catalogs them, finds ways to identify itself as separate from all things, and thereby creates its suffering. So it needs to be a practice. I need to be willing to engage over and over again until it becomes second nature, and then if I practice it and work with it, it can actually become first nature or my default nature. But that's from, you know, giving it my intention, my mind energy, the energy to do what? To focus on the flow of energy, that very subtle creative energy that wants to move through me. Keep my intention focused on that over time throughout the day. Allow whatever happens, which means scanning for resistance. And when I feel it within myself, breathing and releasing the resistance, which moves me back into allowance. And then surrender to be taught by the life, by the light, by the moment. Keep asking, what's mine to learn here? How can I be of service to myself and others? How can I be a blessing in this moment to the flow of life? How can I experience myself as a part of the flow of creation? That's the surrendering, asking to be shown, asking to be taught. And this is, you know, you can just hear as I'm saying it. You can feel how antithetical that is to everything we were taught in schools.
Mm.
It's the opposite of what we're taught in schools and in sports and in religions, right? We go to these religions to get these answers. And, you know, the true spirituality is not about answers. It's about learning to live in the question, learning to understand that you're part of the flow of life. You're not separate from it. and that everything that happens is happening as a flow of life, and you're part of the flow of life, so it's happening for you, not to you. This is the opposite of what we're taught in our families and in our cultures. So yeah, it's going to be different. You know, how many times have you felt you're inadequate? How many times have you thought you're not, you know, that you're stupid or you're a failure or you're just not getting it right? Enough times that it's become a pretty strong, familiar thought pattern, right?
Mm-hmm.
Within you, yeah. And it's never been true. Now, you can create all kinds of impressions and images that can help you rationalize that it's true, but that's never made it true. And think about how long you've had thoughts that I hate myself or I'm a failure or I'm ashamed of myself or whatever because I'm not accomplishing this or that. And has it ever made those thoughts of humiliation and hatred and shame go away?
Mm-mm. Yeah.
No, I'm practicing them so I get better at them.
Right.
And if I want to feel loving toward myself and others, if I want to feel loving towards others, the only way to truly do that is to begin with the recognition that I am as they are, and so I have this affection for myself as well. But if I want to feel that, I have to start practicing that. You can't hate your way towards love. So you have to recognize, hey, if there's a part of me that feels I'm ugly and I'm unlovable and I'm stupid and I'm undesirable and whatever it is, then it's an old voice. It's an old tape playing. It's a younger, wounded part of yourself. It's not accurate. There's a falseness to it. And so I need to get in there and find what's that wounded part of me, that younger wounded part of me, and work directly with it in a hatred way? No, in a loving way, in a gentle, embracing way. I remember one time we had the support group was, for whatever reason, floods or whatever, we were meeting in a person's house, and they played this videotape of Krishnamurti giving a live talk in front of an audience of hundreds. And he said, you know, one of the things that stuck with me from that talk, even though I'd heard the talk several times, this time what stuck with me was Krishnamurti said, we must learn to embrace our negative emotions the way we would comfort a wounded child. So when you say, I feel humiliated, or I hate myself, or I feel like a failure, instead of getting angry with that part of you that feels like a failure or feels humiliated for not having all the answers, we must learn to comfort, embrace, nurture, and support that hurt, wounded part of us the way we would an emotionally wounded child. And if we aren't willing to do that, we end up in the cycle that we practice. We just get better and better at practicing the negative feelings towards self.
Yeah.
And an important part of that for me is, and took my work to the next level, was when I woke up and realized, oh, wait a minute, the part of me that's feeling all these negative thoughts is a younger, wounded part of me. And it's not true that I am a failure and miserable and unlovable. And so it's a younger, wounded part of me that feels that he isn't good enough or that he's a failure. But the actual observable facts of life, I'm okay. I've, you know, made it this far. I make enough money to live on my own. I'm not out there actively hurting other people. I want to do better than I'm, you know, when I make a slip up or I'm somehow inconsiderate with somebody or I, you know, don't make good on a commitment. It's not because I didn't want to. It's because I had an issue. And so I can accept that part of myself. And instead of using it as this evidence that I'm so horrible and such a loser, and I can recognize those thoughts about how I'm a loser and I'm horrible are coming from a younger wounded part of me, and turn the focus inside, make my home in the breath, make my home in the breathing, and soften whatever is rigid within me. Let it emerge and be softened by the breath and be softened by the loving embrace of my allowance, acceptance, and surrender, and my comforting that wounded part of me. That's the fastest way I know to make progress when somebody's having these thoughts of inadequacy or self-loathing or shame in any arena. And the more someone's willing to practice that, what does that mean? Just keep doing it, right? Just like I practice the negative thoughts and the generating humiliation and being raging at myself for not being able to live up to some expectation or some ideal. I've practiced that for a lot of years. That's why it's so strong. So let me practice something else. Let me practice the loving, positive pattern of thought. And it begins with the breath. It's not possible to overestimate the value of returning the focus of your conscious awareness to your breath and using it to soften and allow. Especially in the middle of the night.
All right. That's true.
When you awaken with judgment.
So, Dr. Tim, I have a whole other question. In another direction. I remember in the Way of Mastery at one point, or maybe many times, Yeshua says, actually, it's not just one person, one entity that's speaking to you. We are many. And I've been watching a film called Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind. Have you ever heard of that?
I heard the name. I haven't seen the movie.
Well, it may be going too far away from. I know you like to stay close to the practical use of the tools and how to improve our lives. And this may be going a little far out. But the movie is about the fact that the fifth kind of encounter has to do with the fact, David Bohm who says there is no separation? There are a lot of people Einstein says too, there is no separation between us and our thoughts are connected too. He is saying the fifth encounter is the encounter, the direct encounter of entities like the ones that are speaking in the Way of Mastery with us, and they are loving entities, whereas sort of our government and our, I don't know whether scientists think this too, but the government is terribly protective of our Earth, and we're thinking we may have to unite and go to war with aliens and so forth. Well, when you think about it, aliens could have wiped us out long ago, because if they're intelligent enough to find their way here over light years to morph, shapeshift, or to appear from what we would think is millions of light years away, they have other ways of traveling that aren't physical. They're obviously not going to attack us, so they could have and would have already. These are probably some of these beings that are speaking to us through the Way of Mastery. And the Way of Mastery is so genius because these beings have found a way to communicate with us where we can use what they teach, and they're giving us tools like the Mind of Christ meditation. I know I'm going off, but I am finding this extremely exciting and hopeful. And I anybody who's listening might want it. It's on Amazon Prime if you have that. I don't know if there are other ways of getting it, but it's about 2 hours long. But I've been thinking, if we have these entities who are around us and with us all the time, communicating with us all the time if we're open, then it's really very exciting. And we on the ground, sort of feet on the ground people, the grassroots people, are going to shift the whole mindset, because, you know, starting from the top with the military, they have a fear-based approach to these beings, and we somehow have found our way to feeling as if we are being greatly helped by these beings, whoever they are. I don't even like calling them aliens, because that sounds sort of scary anyway. So I know that's kind of far out. I hope you can whatever.
So is The Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind as a movie, is it about the philosophy and spirituality, or is it about science and aliens?
The document ends up being very spiritual, but it's a documentary.
Okay.
It's not
I'll check it out.
Yeah.
And you know, as you started this off by saying, my strong preference with this work, what we're doing on the internet show, and is to keep it focused on the practical. And the reason for that is because
Dr. Tim, I can't hear you. I don't know if you can hear me, but you have disappeared. I'm going to hang up and dial back in. Oh, you're back. Dr. Tim? Okay, if you can hear me, I can't hear you again. I heard my phone say unmuted. Hello, Susan?
Yeah. Yeah, I can hear you. I think Dr. Tim pushed to let me in because I was in a queue, but we cannot hear him. Very interesting.
Oh, weird.
Yeah,
he unmuted me too, but I don't know who can you hear me?
I can hear you very well. Yes, I can hear you very well. Yeah, very, very interesting. I wonder if him stopping everything and calling it again would help that to resolve or not.
Well, he's apt to do that. It's funny, we were talking about aliens and got shut down.
Yeah, there's like, we're here. Even you said it's not nice to call them aliens, right?
No, it isn't. They are our friends.
Exactly. Well, it seems like everyone that we don't know, it's foreign, right? Until we get to know them. It's like one of my clients asked, "How do you let people come to your house that you don't know?" I said, "Well, you really don't know until you really get to know them, right? And then you know them,
right?" So good to talk to strangers, because they're usually very sweet and friendly.
Exactly.
Wow.
Okay, Dr. Tim.
Thank you for calling CNH Counseling Solutions. If you are a new patient and would like additional information or to schedule an appointment, you may leave a message for Dr. Susan Koh at Extension 3 or Dr. Timothy Hayes at Extension 2. If you have questions about billing or insurance, please contact our office manager at extension 1. Thank you.
Please hold a moment.
So welcome everybody to Aramaicisms. And our topic tonight is going to be the discerning of the truth of the endangered Aramaic thought system. We're going to look into that thought system that sourced at least 6 of the world's major religions, and we're going to work toward understanding, in particular, the first century meanings of its words. I'd like to introduce Aramaic scholar Dale Allen Hoffman, who, as a young man at the age of 15, showed up at our teaching center curious, wanting to know, and he tapped into the Kabor's manuscript in the Aramaic, and the rest is history. He's becoming one of the most renowned practical scholars on the planet. I say practical because there are many scholars who live in their heads, have never had an experience of what actual spirituality is, what the actual presence of love is that is the purpose of these ancient Aramaic teachings, but live in their heads and talk about those things, where Dale travels the globe and teaches people how to have that experience. So Dale, I'm delighted to be here on the stage with you. It's awesome.
Yeah, it is. As a matter of fact, Michael's introducing me so that I can introduce him. And then are you going to introduce me again?
We'll just go for
one. First, let me say welcome. I normally, anybody who's ever been to one of my events before, we always begin with toning and prayer. And I'm actually going to step that a little bit. We're going to do the introductions first. We'll get to the toning and prayer part. I showed up at Heartland in 1995. I want to make this as brief as I can. It was when I was 7 years old that I grew up in the Methodist Church, which I'm happy about because that means I didn't have a lot of fireballs thrown in my face, so I didn't have a lot of things I had to pull out later on. But it was when I was 7 years old that I sat down on my grandmother's living room floor on a carpet, and I laid out 5 different Bibles. And I opened up to the Beatitudes, which was my favorite thing in the world, from the Gospel of Matthew, Matthai, and Aramaic. And I compared them to each other. And I didn't do it because I was trying to learn something. I was just interested. Like, how different is this going to be? The freakish thing was that 2 of them were nothing like the others, and these 3 were basically different from each other. It was just this weird thing. Nothing, and I don't just mean slight variations. I mean none of them really lined up with the other. Then when I was 14, that's when I would sit down and open up to the red words of Jesus in the Bible, and I would write down a couple of the lines and riff on that for line after line after line, and I'd write 8 to 10 pages that nobody ever read because I didn't write it because somebody needed to read it. I read or wrote those because I had to. And then when I was 21, I start getting more into Greek and Aramaic and Hebrew, and I kept hearing about this guy. As a matter of fact, I was in a Course in Miracles study group down in Indian Rocks Beach, Florida, and somebody said to me, Michael Rice is coming to town. I'm like, oh, really? Good. Okay. They're like, he does the Aramaic. And I'm like, what is it, like Macarena or something, does the Aramaic? Funny thing that at that age, as deep as I was into the Bible, I didn't know what Aramaic was. And I'm like, well, what's Aramaic? And they're like, well, that's the language Jesus spoke. And I went, he didn't speak English? And everybody laughing at me, people don't think about that, believe it or not. And then I said Arabic, right? And they're like, no, Aramaic. And I went, aromatic? And they're like, yeah, it means he smells really good. So anyway, here I end up in Clearwater, Florida, at a workshop called Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And literally by the first break, I was like literally sitting on my hands, my eyes are gushing tears, my heart's beating out of my chest, I'm laughing, I'm crying, and I walked up to him, and I still remember that look that he gives, he gave me the look, it was a different kind of a look, and he said, what's happening? He said, it looks like I could peel you off the ceiling right now. And I said, whatever you've got, I want it all. And I ended up at Heartland. And what happened at Heartland is I didn't get deep into the actual language. That came later. What I got deep into was the experience. And I got deep into the actual Aramaic process of forgiveness that's been so misunderstood in the last 2,000 years. You ever play Pass the Secret? You know, you're in kindergarten, and on this end, it's like, the boy in the green shirt fell into a hole, and over here the elephant walked sideways while he was, what, it makes no sense to what's over here. Imagine that in 2,000 years. So I got really deep into that, and then from there I started getting really deep into the language itself, into the texts themselves and translations, and I'll talk a little bit later about things like x-ray copies of Bibles, where you can actually see if ink soaked through from the other side of the page and lands in just the right spot to change either the phonetic marking or the letter itself, which can change the meaning completely. Yeah, it happens more than you'd realize. But the thing that happened in 1995 was I got the base. My heart was opened up by what Michael was teaching, mostly because of the actual forgiveness process, which, of course, we'll probably touch on, I'm sure, in the next few nights.
Sure we will.
But it changed everything for me. And I've seen over the last 20 years, I've seen a lot of people, I've seen Michael's work, he won't say it, I'll say it, borrowed by a lot of people and then twisted because they didn't really put it into practice and understand it. And then they'll kind of repackage it in a different variety that's more palatable for the masses. When it comes to integrity, I know of no person who's out there teaching that, number one, walks it more than him, or has the integrity, and will literally take responsibility right in the present moment for anything that he, on some level, didn't realize, you know, was happening. He'll eat it right there in front of you. So that's a huge, 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 I want to say mentor, but it's like we're brothers, and it's like we're, there's just, it's this egoless relationship. So I want to say thank you for being here, and I'm going to turn it back to him. And I think you should say a little bit about your background first and then talk about how crazy the stuff I've done over the years is or something.
Cool. I was thinking that the first time you came to Heartland, you were about 15. It was
I know,
21?
I was 20.
Okay.
22, actually, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you always say that, so.
I do, I always say that.
That's all right.
What can I say?
You'll forgive it someday, but.
That's true.
So let's set the stage. You are the best translator of Russian into English and English into Russian in the world. And we set up a workshop series, and we hear from this gentleman in Russia who wants to come to the workshop series. And we know you've got an extra room in your house, so we ask if you would mind picking this person up at the airport, translating for them, and housing them, and then taking them back to the airport at the end of the week. And you're just delighted to have that opportunity. And at the end of the week, you know, by the time the week is out, we've had dinner a couple of times, we went out for lunch with this fellow, we had a great time, just a wonderful man. And so at the end of the week, I want him to know, I don't speak any Russian, I want him to know what I think of him. And so I ask if you would tell him that I think that he's really cool. And you say, okay, and you turn to him in Russian, and you say, Michael thinks you've got a low body temperature. Now, you translated my words perfectly, but you obviously didn't say a word about what I meant. In most circles where what is purported to be the teachings of the man named Yeshua, if he walked into those circles and listened to it, he'd say, that's all Greek to me. Because Greek ideas have supplanted his original first century Aramaic thought system. And the Aramaic language is a very idiomatic language. And imagine, let's take a little statement with a couple of idioms in it that you'll understand perfectly because they're idioms in use today in English. But imagine that we're going to put them in a time capsule, and 2,000 years from now, somebody who speaks English is going to unwrap them. We're not going to go through 3, 4, 5 languages, cultures, or anything. We're just going to take this statement, and imagine somebody 2,000 years from now opening and reading this description of this gentleman's day. And so the description goes like this. I went to the office this morning and found myself in a pickle with my boss. And she canned me. I went to my desk to clean it out. I needed to go to the can. I came back, finished cleaning out my desk, went home. My wife was in the kitchen canning, and she said, "Help me if you can," and I said, "I can't." Now you know exactly what I just said. But imagine somebody 2,000 years from now, where who knows what kind of word changes have taken place, imagine what kind of mindset it's going to take to understand what I just said. We have a friend out in California, and he oftentimes houses foreign students. And he had a young Chinese student who came and lived in his home while he was going to school. And this normally happy person came home from school one day all in an upset, like so visibly upset, that my friend Donald said to him, what's going on for you? He said, "Whoa, very bad day at school." And Donald said, "Well, what happened? You seem to have been having such a great time in school." He said, "At school, they called me a very bad name." And Donald said, "Well, what did they call you?" He said, "I looked it up in the dictionary. They called me a very bad name. They said I was a cold cowboy." Donald looked at him. It's like, you know, it's not exactly the vernacular of this language. So he said, "Well, what exactly did they say to you?" "They said I was a cool dude." And I looked it up in the dictionary, and to him, it wasn't a very nice thing to be called a cold cowboy. The Aramaic language is rife with these kinds of problems and challenges. And the thought system in Aramaic, and that's why we're talking about restoring an endangered thought system, the thought system in Aramaic is a complete thought system that includes everything you could possibly experience through your body-mind unit, how to make sure that it stays on track and that you stay in high-level wellness. And that thought system is endangered by a thought system based in hostility and fear. If you've ever held a newborn child, and Jeannie and I have asked the question, how many have ever held a newborn child, and asked people just to describe the essence in the newborn, it's a question we've asked of tens of thousands of people all over the globe. And everybody who describes the essence of their newborn uses a word that reflects some variation on the theme of love. Why? Because everybody knows what human life is. Then we come into the culture, and the culture starts to put its thumbprints on us. And once we are struck with those thumbprints, we tend to lose awareness of the experience of ourselves as this awesome active presence of love, and the cellular effect of that experience, which is bliss and ecstasy. The child comes in experiencing that, and we're designed to live in that. And the culture with its thumbprints changes the thought system from one that supports living in that state to one based in a different state. The second question that Jeannie will usually ask at the opening of the Why Is This Happening to Me Again workshop is, how many have ever done something they regret? And again, having asked tens of thousands of people that question, everybody's answer is some variation on the theme of hostility or fear. The language and the thought system of hostility and fear is replacing the language and the thought system and the support system for living as human beings, for living as love. It's as though human life is almost gone from the planet. And what we're looking to do is to solidify and restore an understanding of that first century Aramaic thought system that supports us really truly experiencing living in our physiology in ecstasy and bliss, 24/7, 365, whatever's going on in our world. What we feel from is designed to come from being, the state of a human life, who we are. And we get converted, we get shifted out of that into a thought system based in hostility or fear, and once we plug into that, then our minds tend to work and produce everything it produces in that hostility and fear system, which is insane compared to the system based in human life. I define insanity as a human form without the active presence of love in it. If you go back 2,000 years ago, you hear this man, Yeshua, saying, "My words are your perfect life." You'll notice he doesn't say, I am. He says, my words are. Vladimir Lenin says, you can destroy a culture by doing one simple thing. All you have to do is change the meaning of its words. Well, how could you destroy a culture by changing the meaning of words? Culture is transferred from generation to generation through words and thought. If you change the thought behind words that are important to living as love, then you lose the ability to live as you're designed to live. We are here to convert everybody on the planet, not into anyone's church. That's the non-being mind's cheap copy of conversion. Conversion is bringing each of us back to a love-based thought system, a love-based mind that works as it was designed to work. You can go back into the 6th century, and there was a man named Rabbala. He was a bishop. And Rabbala decided he knew how it should work. Rabbala is the root word for our idiom today of a rabble-rouser. That's the kind of mind this guy had. He went everywhere he could and destroyed every Aramaic writing he could find, every Aramaic scripture, and replaced it with his own translations. And what we're looking to do is to reestablish the Aramaic thought system and come back to the truth of who we are.
We're going to get into some wild stuff tonight. There's a base I'd like to set. Actually, there's a quote I have. This is from a guy that's been a huge inspiration to me, and I think that there's certain people that, I think people that are out there teaching this guy's teachings and sort of twisting those a bit too. His name's Ernest Holmes. Anybody ever heard of him before? He said, if the philosophy of Christianity were lived, wars would cease, unhappiness would cease, economic problems would be solved, poverty would be wiped from the face of the earth, and man's inhumanity to man would be transmuted into a spirit of mutual helpfulness. And here's the base that I'd like to lay before we go forward. But we're going to talk a bit more about this either later tonight or tomorrow. But everybody, I talked about those Beatitudes. I've had this relationship with the Beatitudes since I was about 5 years old. Everybody know what the Beatitudes are? Maybe, maybe not. Anybody know what the third Beatitude is? It's one of the questions I get asked the most. Anybody know their Beatitudes? This is from the Sermon on the Mount, first public teaching of Yeshua. Okay, I'll give you a little bit of a hint. They're the blessed are statements. We're going to get to those a little bit later. But the third one says, blessed are the meek. Even though it's a subject for later in the evening, I wanted to start with this base, at least for me. First of all, it doesn't translate as blessed are the doormats. Okay? That word, the best word that I can give you in English for this, because this to me is one of the absolute bedrocks of being able to be open to learn, the best word I can give you in English is humility. Now, humility comes from the Latin word humus, which isn't a Middle Eastern chickpea dip that's like great with pita breads and carrots and stuff. That's hummus. Humus. Anybody know what humus means? What's humus? Any gardeners? Soil. It's that. It's the earthy open. It's the earthy open soil that has those beautiful fertile roots, and water can flow very much through it. Humus literally is a Latin root that means an open relationship with the earth, open, flowing. From the Tao Te Ching, where it says the Tao is like a river flowing home to the sea. It also says in the Tao that there's nothing more powerful yet yielding than water. Okay? Now, the reason I say this is because one of the things that we definitely, in his decades and my decades of study, one of the things we don't see a lot of is humility. What we do see a lot of is, I know what I'm talking about and I'm the expert, whatever that may be. It's intriguing. You can mark my words on this. I would say film it and, you know, put it somewhere, but that's happening anyway. The people that are considered biblical experts today, okay, 2015, especially in terms of Christianity, over the next two decades, many of them are going to be turned on their heads. And the people that are looked at as the disturbing elements out on the fringe who are talking about things that other people label conspiracy theories, etc., are all of a sudden going to be pulled into the center of the room, and people are going to honor and say, guess what? You were right. And this means people like Bart Ehrman, Elaine Peggles, James Tabor, there's just so many names I can pull out of the hat. Lots of people that are, people are labeling them as being just trying to like be troublemakers or something. And here's the thing. Just because a theology or a belief system, BS, is predominant and widely spread and everybody seems to buy into it, doesn't mean that's what's correct. Okay? And there's one thing that can become danger, and that's fundamentalism, because what fundamentalism can masquerade as is keeping a truth alive in its original intention. The danger in that is all it needs is a slight shift here, and then a slight shift here, and then a slight alteration here, and a slight alteration here. Remember, past the secret, and you go several thousand years down the line, and people think they're getting what's real, but that's not necessarily what they're getting. And here's the other thing. When you're in the fences of theology, there's a danger in that because you're told, look, if you stay in this fence, you're safe, you are in the family, you are in our social club, we will support you, we will love you. If something happens, if you're starving, we'll come feed you. But don't go outside of the fence. What happens when you go outside of the fence? Intriguingly, I started with a guy that was already outside of the fence, which I'm happy about, because here's the thing. I started going to lots of conventions, started going very deep into like symposiums that would last a week on ancient languages. And I used to notice, I started noticing after a while that the people that screamed the loudest and their eyes would bulge the furthest out of their head like a Simpsons cartoon were the ones that usually won the arguments. Interesting thing, the one that didn't give up. And that's when I started studying, you know, lots of different things that tied right in with Aramaic, like the way that you can actually go and go to a theological seminary, some kind of biblical-based academy, and get one sentence mentioning that, by the way, the Jesus guy spoke Aramaic, and okay, back to the Greek thing now. And I had issues with this, and I started digging in, why would this happen, why would this happen? And I started studying guys like Irenaeus, that was the guy that is responsible for, as an example, changing the gospel of the beloved disciple, which was about a woman, into the gospel of John, which is about a man. He's the guy that oversaw the forgeries of a lot of the Pauline letters that are still in the Bible today. Looked in Constantine, and I saw that an original Aramaic thought system that was broken down and broken down and broken down and twisted and manipulated, and let's bring in some Egyptian mythology, which is basically the entire history of the Jesus lifetime. And you start looking at all these things and you start learning what's actually real anymore. And that's when I started to realize that truth is not something I'm going to find on a page. It's not something in the letters. Truth is a direct experience. There's a real danger in thinking that the concepts in your mind that you're projecting on letters on the page are what's right, as opposed to the realization that what you are looking for is what is looking, in the words of St. Francis of Assisi. And that's what I got from Michael's work. That's what I got from actually doing the breath work and doing the forgiveness process and realizing that Yeshua wasn't telling us to go out there and add stuff in. He was actually showing us how to take things off. And this actually, Michael was speaking of that joy and that ecstasy. Probably one of the most misunderstood teachings that came out of Yeshua's mouth has to do with prayer. Do you want to start that off?
Sure, yeah. Well, you look at that word and you hear the disciples asking Yeshua, teach us to pray. Now, let's imagine that I'm a voice teacher and you said to me, Michael, teach me to sing. Would I be teaching you to sing if I sang you a song? Obviously not. What would I do? I'd give you some instructions for how to sing. Many people are shocked to realize that what the world has called the Lord's Prayer isn't a prayer. It's a set of instructions for how to pray. And in Aramaic, what does the word prayer mean? Well, it's kind of a shock for most people in the West until they start to understand it. But the word means, more closely, to set a trap for God. which the average mind goes, well, what does that mean, to set a trap for God? Well, if you think about your television set and you've got an antenna on the roof and you're tuned to channel 2, if your antenna is shaped properly and oriented correctly, then your antenna is a trap for channel 2, feeds a good signal in, and you get a clear picture and clear sound. If someone goes up and bends the arms on the antenna, turns it backward, or drives into the parking lot with a car that's poorly tuned, then you're not going to have a very good trap or device to bring that signal in. So in Aramaic, there's the recognition that this physiological device is designed to capture the live, active presence of love and bring it into the world. What is God? God is love. So when we are properly attuned and aligned, and the word that's been translated as soul can also be properly translated as attuning mechanism, when we're attuned, then there is this awesome active presence of love that sprays or radiates from us onto everyone. Anyone who walks the world in that modality is a walking field for healing humanity. And so what you find in the Aramaic Lord's Prayer is, here's how you attune and align yourself to be the space where love shows up. So it's a set of instructions. As I can remember three times, the third time I wrote the Beatitudes out using the dictionary in the back of our publication, Kabouras, the Enlightenment book. And I was always taught that the Beatitudes were this nice philosophy. And the third time I wrote it out longhand, we've got a first century dictionary in the back of that book, Enlightenment. The first time I wrote it out longhand, it was like, oh my God, this is an instruction set. This is a how-to. The so-called Lord's Prayer isn't a prayer. It's an instruction set for how to capture and reflect into the world the active presence of love, especially if you're facing what the world calls an enemy. How do you do that? You know, there are lots of nice words that are said about, well, you should love your neighbor, but if you've got somebody who's full of rage and you tell them to love their neighbor, chances are they're going to end up in huge amounts of guilt because they have no clue how to love their neighbor, and therefore when their rage, their fear, their sadness, their anger comes up, they've failed and they are dashed into the dirt and they buy the belief system that there's something wrong with them, when the truth is nobody showed them how to do that. And if nobody shows us how to do something, how do we do it? The Lord's Prayer is a set of instructions for how to do that. The Beatitudes are a set of instructions for how to activate an unconscious neural structure that's designed to guide us to happiness and well-being. So we see instructions, and by and large, that's the piece that's been lost, because you can't understand, truly understand a set of instructions until you follow them. You can't talk about a set of instructions until you've truly experienced them. You can't describe the result of following a set of instructions until you follow them and experience the result. So we see lots of people, in fact, Yeshua talked about these people 2,000 years ago. He says, you put all these people to their work, and you won't touch one bit of it yourself. And that, unfortunately, is what's happened with the ivory tower. I remember Dale sharing with me, being at a conference, and they're arguing over the meaning of words, and Dale said, well, has anybody ever tried this?
Put it into practice, maybe?
Put this into actual practice? What happened when you did that?
They looked at me as if I had lobsters crawling out of my ears for about 20 seconds, and then they just looked back at each other and started arguing again as if I didn't even exist. So that was a good lesson.
Yeah. So what we want to do is get down to the practical how-to and to understand what those first century meanings meant. Love is not something we do to each other. Love is a state of being. Think about the newborn. It's not something the newborn's doing, it's what the newborn is. When I ask you to tap into the experience of holding a newborn, notice you don't have to go to your head or your intellect to do that. You go back to the experience of that presence that was there. If I ask you that other question, How many have ever done something they regret? Notice you have to go into your head and think about this event and, oh, what did I do? What did I feel? This is all something that's happening in the head. And ultimately, in order to heal, the key tool will be the tool of forgiveness. And what it does is it empowers you to be out of your mind, to drop the mental games and get into the actual experience of yourself as this awesome active presence of love, living through a form that is attuned, that is a trap, that captures and gives a place for you to embody and express in the world. This physicist, Yeshua, 2,000 years ago said, a little leavening leavens the whole loaf. I think we're fairly safe in assuming he wasn't talking about bread. What was he talking about? He was saying, if we can get enough human beings incarnated into human forms, then we're going to create a critical mass of love that is going to shift and heal every mind on the planet. And so that's what we're aiming to do, is to give people the tools and understand in context, in the first century, the instructions he was giving for how to experience yourself as this awesome active presence of love, regardless of what's going on in your world. And when you do that, you'll naturally live in humility, and it is that fertile place. And it's an ability, it's a mental ability to see and cooperate with the highest and best in others. When you're in your hostility or fear-based mind, how many have ever had the experience of, you know, I just heard it's about love, I got it, it's about love, and you went home to that person, you said, I got it, it's about love, and that's where I'm going to live forevermore, especially with you. And then that's what you did with that person, right? Until the next time they gave you the look. And what happened to your resolve to live as love? If nobody gave you the tool of forgiveness, you didn't know how to do it, because that look resonated something out of your body's mind that was different than love. And when it comes up, like Goliath in the story of David and Goliath, it takes over. And your choice is rendered useless. And so how do you actually embody and incarnate a human life in a human form? Just because someone has what looks like a human body does not mean there's human life in there. If you listen to Yeshua, he said, I come to bring you life and bring it more abundantly. He didn't say, I come to bring you fear, I come to bring you threat, I come to bring you suffering. He said, I come to bring you life. I come to teach you how to pray, how to incarnate as the active presence of love and extend that to all the world. And when we move into that space, everything changes. It's not a head game anymore. It's not an intellectual journey.
See, I'm already writing things down. I knew it. As soon as we start going, I'm like, ooh, we didn't think of that one. There's a subject, and then I'm going to refocus back on the Lord's Prayer itself, which is this. You know, one of the things a lot of people don't realize is that when you sit in English, look at the words of Jesus. Jesus comes from the Greek word that means Hail Zeus, in case you didn't know that. Intriguingly, when you sit and you look at it from an English perspective, a lot of people don't realize that the words that you're seeing on the page weren't actually there originally. Maybe you just, you know it on some level, but you're not really acknowledging it. One of those words that, trying to think of, oh, I come to give you life and give it abundantly. The word life. Now let me say something here first. It's an intriguing thing when I started really getting deep into Aramaic, because if I met 10 different people, they would say the same words 10 different ways. Their cops were chets, and there was just all these kinds of like going from Boston to where they park the car to going down, you know, around here. I can't do Southern for some reason, even though I've been here for 12 years. I just can't. I can say y'all or all y'all. I think up to three is y'all. For three or four or more, it's all y'all. But I don't have the dialect in there. Intriguingly, though, looking at that phrase, I come to give you life and give it abundantly, that word life in Aramaic is chaya, or chaya, okay? In Jesus' language, chaya. There's a bunch of other words that word was translated as. Chaya is the word life. I come to give you life, give it abundantly. You ever heard, like, saved? People ask me that sometimes, you know, some of the sort of, like, what exists as American evangelical white Christianity today, number one, does not exist outside of this country unless an American took it there. Number two, it's only about 3 or 4 decades old, okay? The thought systems, the lingo, the words they use, it's very new. One of those things that I get asked is, have you been saved? Now let me ask you a question briefly here. Let's say that your kid is playing with a ball in the front yard and whatever, you're trimming the hedges, and there's a car going by 50 miles an hour in a 20 mile an hour zone, and the child runs to grab the ball from the middle of the street, and you run as fast as you can to grab the child and pull that child back. What did you just do? You saved them, right? What does save mean? What does it mean to save?
Preserved life. Preserved life.
You just preserved life. You just, a life that appeared like it was about to end, and you kept it going. Save is the word chaya in Aramaic. Resurrection, I am the resurrection and the life. The word resurrection in Aramaic is the word chaya. There's a lot of words that theology was laid on top when it was the same word in so many different places. Another word would be amen, which is at the end of the Lord's Prayer, right? Amen. Amen. Intriguingly, there's no sound in ancient Aramaic. There's no eh. So if you say amen, there is no sound in that language like that, okay? Now, intriguingly, amen, if you ever heard assuredly I say to you, or verily, verily, I say to you, that's actually the word amen. Interesting. It was changed. Why was it changed? Who knows? We're going to talk about a lot of words like that, but now I want to focus for a few minutes just on the Lord's Prayer itself. We'll revisit the word Lord later, but I will say this just very briefly. Jesus was never called Lord. Jesus never called anything or anyone Lord. I can say that absolutely. You know why I know that as a fact, even though I wasn't there? Because the word Lord did not exist. Okay? Now, that word Lord that's translated from the Greek is kurios, which comes from kairos, which means essentially outside of time and space. It's a realization that would be a sister word of agape, which is essentially oneness with everything. Okay? Now, that word Lord in Aramaic sounds like this, Maria, Maria. We're going to come back to this sound a little bit later, Maria. Interesting. Did you know that? Jesus didn't say Lord. He said Maria. Later on, we'll talk about what that means, what the actual word means completely. But here we are. We've got something we're calling the Lord's Prayer. Does anybody know where the word Lord comes from, the English word? Really, that's basically it. It comes from feudalism. It comes from feudalism, basically within the realm of the Church of England, actually even prior to the Church of England. We might get to King James at some point, interesting fellow. But literally, it comes from feudalism, and he was the landowner, he was the giver of life, the bread giver. It was a codependent power person term. Stop using the word Lord. It has nothing to do with what was there originally. And just very briefly, that word for Lord, Maria, the Mar, I say we'll talk about it a little more later. Mar in Aramaic means a bedrock of strength, something coming from bedrock. You know the red rock in the sky, Mars? Mar and Rhea. What does Rhea or Rhea sound like? Re, Re, Ra, Aura. They're all Aramaic root sounds. Life, sun. Light, excuse me, light or sun. Rhea, Maria. Literally means one who shines a raya, feminine light. Feminine light is not the masculine light that we see, but well, you mentioned about holding a baby. That light that a baby exudes, that's not something you're seeing, it's sensed. Do you understand what I'm saying? Those who radiated that light from a place, from a bedrock of strength, were called Lord. Interesting, Maria. If you put an M on the end of Maria, which is the letter Mem, it literally is Mariam or Miriam, which is the word Mary, intriguingly. So what we're going to do is a little bit briefly about prayer, and then what I'm going to do is actually pray the prayer for you. But I'm not going to pray it in a sort of just everyday wishy-washy, spit it out like, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. Even in Aramaic, I'm not going to do that. It's important. It's funny. You can actually find recordings of people speaking the Aramaic Lord's Prayer in all these different dialects.
and they're usually going so fast, it's like they're trying to like do it at like a NASCAR race or something so that they can get the flag or something. It has nothing to do with it. Funny, in Matthew, it doesn't say pray these words. In Matthew, it says pray in this way. Okay? Now, prayer is something that Michael mentioned, setting a trap for God. That word in Aramaic is sluta. Sluta is the word prayer, okay? Now, the ta genders the word feminine. That's an intriguing thing. I don't want to go too deep, but I will say this in terms of language, and this is especially in Aramaic, specifically. There's a lot of languages where masculine and feminine get a little wishy-washy. It gets a little wishy-washy in some of the other Semitic languages. Let me explain what it means, okay? My perception of this flashlight that's in my hand is feminine, okay? The actual light itself that I'm holding is masculine. Feminine meaning experiential. My perception of it, it's a little bit of a slippery slope because we're learning so much about perception right now, but my awareness of the flashlight is feminine. The actual thing itself is masculine, okay? Now, what that means is this. Sluta, prayer, isn't a thing. It's not words on a page. It's not words that you speak. It's your being. You remember when Yeshua said, pray in my name? Anything you ask the Father in my name, John 15:16. And a lot of times, all the time now, you hear, in the name of the Lord Jesus. You know, if you actually say in English, in the name of the Lord Jesus, you commit blasphemy. Number one, his name was not Jesus. Number two, that's not what name, Shem, Shemach, meaning my name, meant in Aramaic. Now this is the gist before you actually hear the prayer itself. Shem is this. Let me give you Shem. And if you study other Semitic languages, they're not Aramaic, okay? Let me give you it this way. A good example would be Michael Jackson. If I say Michael Jackson, who in this room is just seeing the letters M-I-C-H-A-E-L-J-A-C-K-S-O-N? Who's happening with that? Just letters. Anybody? What happens when I say Michael Jackson? Aaron's especially smiling, Mr. Music Man. So it's like you're probably seeing his face, you're probably hearing his voice, you're perceiving his consciousness, his overall what? Vibration, essence. You get what I'm saying? And that's Shem. Pray in my Shem is not, number one, pray in my name. Number two, the name isn't about the letters or the things that you speak, but rather when the name is invoked or spoken, you have the awareness of that person's energy pattern, essentially. And when you hear pray in my name, it's not saying the name Yeshua even, it's literally saying pray from this place. And I'm pretty sure after he said that, he didn't go, Abun, Devashmaya, Nikarashmak, Tete, Malkitak. I'm pretty sure it didn't happen that way. So what I'm going to do is give you a little bit of an example of that. That word, that setting a trap for God, Slota, there's two aspects of that in Aramaic. One aspect is that you have a vision and or something that has been taken from a point of intention to a point of a goal, and you hold that in your awareness. And whether you hold it in your arms, loving it and embracing it, or you resist it, as an example, let's say there's, Michael uses this all the time, I'll say this, don't think about Barack Obama, okay? I want you to think about something other than Barack Obama. No Barack Obama. Don't think Barack Obama. And occasionally people will say, Dale, I wanted to let you know I'm not thinking about what you said to think about. And I'm like, oh, what is it that you're not thinking about right now? And that's the trap. Now here's the thing. One aspect of Slota or prayer is you have that vision. And this is a vision that either you are 100% for or against. Because as an example, if someone's got a nervous tick and you try not to think about it and eventually it drives you out of your mind, this is exactly the same thing. What you push back against, you recreate. It's much like a fractal. And anything that you hold in your awareness, your vision, expands just like this. And there's a force called Rucha, which we'll get to later, Ruach in Hebrew, Ruch in Arabic, Pneuma in the Greek. Now, intriguingly, there's another aspect of prayer, which is not just a vision that you hold, like I want to manifest this or whatever that may be, but rather this, that you're just open. There's nothing that you're seeking to create, but you're simply open in the humility and the essence of the moment, and it opens through you, and it literally lives through you. Like, as an example, let's look at it this way. Take a breath. Take another one. Okay, you can open your eyes. Let me ask you a little question. What's happening right now? You took two breaths. But what about right now? Are you breathing or are you being breathed? You see the difference? The first one had a goal to take a breath. But it's happening right now without the goal, and that expansion is still happening. This is the difference between what you want and heaven on earth. Your idea of heaven on earth is not heaven on earth. That's not a new earth. Heaven on earth is when your ideas get wiped clean off the slate and heaven can live through you. That's what a new earth comes from. And this is where prayer should come from. Not about words or ideas, but rather from the vibration, the essence itself. So I'm just going to ask you to be open for a few minutes. And I'm not going to, like I say, spit out some scholarly thing. I'm actually going to come down here and just make some sounds. We're going to make a sound first that...
Can I throw in a thought before you do that?
Sure.
First of all, interesting that the word heaven can be properly translated as expansion, the kingdom of expansion.
Shemaya.
And when Dale speaks the Lord's Prayer, intones it, I'm going to just invite you to imagine as you close your eyes that, and we know that from a point of view of physics, time and space is an illusion. So I'm going to ask you to imagine yourself transported back to the shore of the Sea of Galilee. You're not listening to Dale Allen Hoffman. You're actually listening to Yeshua's voice and feeling his presence that opens and awakens you to that state where the active presence of love flows through you.
Mm. If you spit out words, you're not praying. I want to acknowledge, Nick, before we do this, and it seems like it's like, okay, we're getting into this deep place, and why would he do this? As an example, a couple of months ago, I sat across from you at West End Bakery here, and you were like, oh, I've been learning the Lord's Prayer in Aramaic. And he had been working on it for about 2 weeks, so I'm expecting like a train wreck, clunky, you know, sidesteps, all kinds of wild stuff. But from the first word, I felt his heart go, and it was like he got it. He got it. He got the heart. And it's funny, when you get the heart, when you get the vibration, the Shem, the prayer takes care of itself because it's never about the words, okay? So let's just be open. I'm just going to offer this to you. All you need to do is just be aware of your breath. I'm going to do a few tones before I make say the actual prayer itself. And I'm going to give you an English experiential translation. This is not a theological black and white literal words on the page. This is what's the breadth and the breath and what's the vibration and the essence of what this actually means. Okay? So just stay open. Kadash Shmach Tete Malku Toch Nehwe Tsubyanak Vaikana Voshmea Ap Bearea Hablan Lochmadasun Kanan Yomana Voshvochlan Hobin Wachtahain I kana dab hanan shwakan lachayabin. Wela tachlan lenesiune ilapatsan minbisha. Metul didelaki malkuthach wahailo wateshbukta. La alam almin. Just stay open.
our one absolute eternal being of which we are born forth from the realm of the all and the only. I am empty within the ecstasy of your presence and the purity of your name. Empower my creative expansion from your emergence from the unseen realms as I realize our strength and light as one on the manifest earth as in the unmanifest heavenly realms. Provide the nourishment of true insight and realization through me now and in every present moment. Release the echoes of my hidden past. Do not let me lose my true self in forgetfulness and wholly release me from the errors of my perception. For the undivided realm is the absolute, the all, and the only, and our strength of gleaming magnificence. From cosmic gathering to cosmic gathering, from age to age, from aeon to aeon, from moment to moment, from now to now. May these clear words be the rooted, fertile earth from which all my actions flow. Amen. Amen. Now you can open your eyes, or you can keep them closed. It took me a while of working with Aramaic before I realized that what's held in mind was the very thing that Yeshua was cracking like an eggshell. He was getting us to crack, you know, in the words of Joseph Chilton Pierce, the crack in the cosmic egg.
Well, it's an interesting thought to pick up on. And if we look at this device we call a body-mind unit, there's some interesting Harvard research that says that in a time frame where 10,000 brain cells fire. That is, there are approximately 10,000 measurable units of electrical activity happening in this structure. That in that same time frame, which is about a 25th of a second, the max amount of information that can go into your awareness or your perception, the construct of your mind that makes things appear a certain way, and you remember Yeshua said, don't judge by appearances. These things that show up in your mind are appearances, and they're made of a maximum, according to that Harvard research, of 9 chunks of information. And what those thumbprints do when we come into the world is they attempt to shut us down to this 9-bit mind where whatever is stored in the body's mind is all we have access to. And so we have this maximum, and I refer to it as metaphorically the 9-bit mind. And we've been forced into that perception. Our so-called educational systems, which have nothing to do with education, the word educare comes from the root to draw out, it does not mean to put in, but those systems tend to shut us down to this 9-bit mind. And we lose awareness of everything else we're designed to be in touch with. Our ecstatic states come from what I call whole field perception. When we listen to Einstein, he says, on such things as matter, we've been all wrong. What we've heretofore called matter is energy. Energy whose vibrations have become so lowered as to be perceptible to the senses. There is no matter. So we have this energy field, and we are designed to experience life through all facets of this energy field. When you go into the world of physics, you hear them saying that every molecule in the universe is in continuous communication with every other molecule in the universe. Now tie that physics idea to the ancients' idea of the Creator being omnipresent. If the Creator is omnipresent, and in that presence we live, move, and have our being, then obviously if we went off into every corner of the universe, we would find embodied love. And if I were to just place these hearts into every corner of our board and let that represent the presence of that love coming to us from every molecule in the universe. It's what the physicists are saying. Now, you think about that, and if every molecule is in continuous communication, does that mean that every molecule is continuously sending you information? And if your whole field is open, then you're receiving information and guidance from every molecule in the universe. If the Creator is omnipresent, embodied in all of this, could we properly say that these energies that physics is talking about are in fact the spirit? The ruha, the breath of the Creator coming to us, and as it comes to us, could we be guided by this whole creation if our fields were open to it, which kings don't like, because if you're open and you're guided by that, you become the offspring of the Creator. The ancient said, as many are sons and daughters of love, of God, as are led by the Spirit of God. If we hadn't been shut down to a 9-bit mind, if we were able to be open to receive this input from the whole creation, are we then properly called the offspring of the Creator, sons and daughters of the Creator, rather than sons and daughters of what's going on in the 9-bit mind? If you talk to a modern-day physiologist, they'll tell you that your so-called body has as its base element, carbon. Did the man named Yeshua live in continuous communication with the whole of the Creator's essence? Or did he live in his 9-bit mind? To those who lived in their 9-bit mind, he said, I have a different father than you. I have a different source than you. Your source comes from what is stored within your device and your 9-bit perception, your appearances. And if you live there, then you are governed and guided by Adamos, the red clay, carbon. And if you look at a carbon atom, what you'll find is that in each carbon atom, there are 6 electrons, 6 protons, and 6 neutrons. 666. The mark of the past. Everything stored in carbon-based memory is of the past. And if we're stuck in perception from the past, then we are the offspring of the liar, as Yeshua said. He said, your father's a liar. There's no truth in him. Anything that appears in your 9-bit mind from the past is from the past. It's obviously not true right now. But if you buy the perception that comes from the past, you'll act as though what was going on in you 2, 10, 20, 50, 5,000 generations ago is true now. And therefore you're stuck in the lie. That's what led Yeshua to say. There's no truth in that framer of your structure. And he says, I have a different father. I live in a different place. And I'm inviting you to go there. I'm here to connect you with the spirit of truth and to knock you out of your 9-bit mind. Those who are locked into their 9-bit mind are really into their money and their stuff and their control and their power and all the games that basically kings play.